Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Okay, folks, welcome to the latest chapter, the latest page of history from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how are you this fine day? And I mean that sincerely, folks, because when I say fine day, as we are sitting here now recording, the rain is lashing against my window. The wind is howling. The leaves are fluttering down from the trees. The brown carpet is being made as we speak. And the very first thing I'm going to do after we finish this broadcasting is go for a walk over the North Downs, because I love this sort of weather. I think you're a bit partial to a bit of rain as well yourself, aren't you, Miss Jones?
I do like the rain, Mr. Parry, yes. I'm not so partial to the wind, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I can dress all up in all the right sort of wet weather gear, but if you've got the wind coming at you in your face and blowing mm-hmm. all your hair in your eyes and stuff, that's not so much fun. But I do like autumnal weather. Mm. And I think we've touched on this before. I think we tend to like the weather of the season in which we were born.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right, yeah. And I was born on the 29th of December, so that's midwinter, really, although I prefer autumn. I don't mind winter weather. I love it. I love snow and all that kind of stuff, but there we are. When I go walking on the North Downs, I do it without a coat on. I think having a coat is pointless and superfluous when it's raining, because when you get home, your coat's very wet, and you've got to hang it up somewhere or hang it over the bath if it's dripping wet or something like that, whereas if it's not cold, and it's not usually cold in autumn, it's certainly not that cold today, I'm very happy in a pair of jeans and a shirt, and I don't mind getting drenched.
Yeah, but you'll catch your death of cold, no, as your grandmother used to tell you.
No, I don't think you do. I mean, you know, I believe that colds are airborne. You know, it's something you catch from, you know, a bit like COVID. It's a virus in the air, but you don't get a cold from being soaking wet. If you did, it means people would get a cold every time they went swimming.
I suppose there's something in that, but I do believe in wrapping up my neck. There's something about that entry point, you know, at the base of your throat.
Sure.
I'm sure germs get in there somehow, you know, and I always find if I wrap my neck up, just a nice scarf around my neck or something, it just makes me feel a little bit warmer, a bit more secure.
Yes.
And I'm sure that a wrapped neck is the way to go.
Yeah, well, yeah, could be. But then again, your scarf gets wet and then you're carrying around the wetness around your neck. But anyway, look, we've all got a different theory on these things. Now, of course, I've got a huge, huge victory to celebrate. I've got my passport back. And as I
say,
I have it in my hand, the new blue passport. The old passport only had one picture of you on the page in the back, okay? As I speak to you now, wait a minute, here we are.
You said you had it in your hand.
Well, I had it in my hand and I tossed it away as I started speaking to you.
The passport. Oh, no, sorry. No,
yeah. Family. Excuse me, Miss Jones. For goodness sake, it doesn't take much, does it, eh? But in the new one, you open it and there's a picture of you there. It says British passport.
It's not a picture of me. It's supposed to have a picture of you.
Exactly, a picture of me. And then you go on to, you know, what used to be the old information page in the back of your passport, but it's now in the front of your passport. And there's another picture of me there. But right above that, this page is reserved for official observations. So I don't know what that means. I suppose that means as you're going through, you know, customs or something, they could put some official observations. But that's got a picture of me as well. So that's three pictures, whereas you only used to have one. But anyway, there we go.
Just to remind you who you are.
Yes, to remind you who you are, I suppose. But you're still having a bit of a problem, aren't you, Leslie Ann?
Well, I am, but I made some progress yesterday because I got a call from a very nice young lady called Hannah mm-hmm. at Her Majesty's Passport Office,
right,
who admitted to me over the phone that they have a problem at their end when they relaunched the counter service through which you can apply for a fast-track passport. She said this, that they had not anticipated the demand, which is why we've got the problem we have today. A fast-track passport is supposed to come back to you within a week. And your supporting documents, so if you're doing something like changing your name in your passport or making some other significant change for which you need to submit things like your birth certificate,
yes,
or your marriage certificate, your divorce decree, absolute, whatever, as in the case of me, because I was changing back to my maiden name, which you wouldn't believe how difficult it is to do that.
Really?
On things like a driving license or a passport and so on. You absolutely have to prove who you started out as,
right?
And they're very suspicious about that.
Yeah, well, I should think they are, because
I was asked three times during the interview, why are you changing your name? And I responded, I'm not changing my name, I'm returning to my original name. I thought that was an okay thing to do, but apparently this raises great suspicion in official offices these days. Anyway, she says that they're on the case. I make contact with customer services through Twitter. Hasn't Twitter been amazing in our campaign to get our passports?
Well, I think it does show the influence Twitter have. I mean, the problem with Twitter is that many people on Twitter are just trolls. So if there's a service that's not working, I think those people who are responsible, like the passport office, are a bit worried that once the trolls get their teeth into something that's deemed to be inefficient, they never let it go. And then, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, the passport office doesn't work, even if it's an isolated case and they get their act together and 99% of the applications are properly processed.
Yeah, I agree. But they didn't like the fact that we were tweeting them, so they jumped on the case. I mean, having been ignored all that time before, isn't it interesting that you put something on Twitter and suddenly they're calling you?
Yes.
Anyway, she's promised to sort it out. It's been referred to customer services, whatever else.
Yeah.
And I'm basically saying I paid for a fast-track passport. It didn't arrive in time. Therefore, I should be entitled to a refund.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I mine should have come on May the 20th. And the reason why it's gone on so long is because I was told at the time there'll be a 10-week wait. So for the first 2.5 months, I didn't bother checking it out. And then it got to 3 months. I thought, oh, I better check out where that passport is. You didn't need a passport during lockdown because nobody would go anywhere. You see what I mean? So it wasn't that urgent. So when I started trying to find out again, they sent me a list of times that allegedly TNT had tried to deliver it to my home. But I never got one call. I never got a card left. Nobody ever rang my bell. So yesterday when I got it, I got a message from the passport, or this saga is going on forever, got a message from the passport office in the morning saying, TNT will deliver your passport today. I thought, brilliant. Except that 3 days earlier, they told me it was coming on Wednesday. So that's Tuesday and Wednesday, completely written off because I've got to stay in to make sure that I'm here. Anyway, I was literally scanning the road, you know, from my my penthouse Erie, and a white van turned up, a little white van. And I thought, well, that doesn't look like TNT. You know what the colour TNT vans are. They're brown, aren't they, with gold lettering on them. You know.
That's the other one.
Oh, is it?
DPS, UPS.
Is it? I don't. There's quite a few of them around these days. PDP and all that kind of
stuff. Who knows what they
call. Yeah. But anyway, so I looked at this little white van, and a Rastafarian chap got out, okay? So he parked in front of my penthouse, right, my apartment block. This Rastafarian chap gets out, clutching a white package about the size of something in which there could be a passport, right? And I thought, no, this can't be right, surely. Anyway, he walks up my driveway, and I'm thinking, could it be? Then my buzzer goes because they ring you from downstairs. So, you know, in a state of high excitement, I answer, hello. Yeah. Oh, hello, Mr. Parry. Yeah. I've got a package for you here from the passport office. I couldn't believe my luck. Oh, no. And I have to open the door and I have to shout down the stairs because after the lift, the last floor has to come up through stairs, you see. And I said, I'm up here, mate. And he came up and he was as happy for me as I was to get the passport. He couldn't contain his joy. You know, I'm so glad to have delivered it to you and all this kind of stuff. It was a wonderful service in the end. So there we are.
Yeah, I have a beef with TNT, though, because they don't actually do the job properly. They send you photographs of your house and say, we tried to deliver X today, but it was impossible to deliver. You look at the photograph on their website of your address, and it's not your address. It's somewhere else completely.
Yeah, well, I had...
They don't get out of the van, and they don't look for the place properly.
Well, funny enough, they found a picture from May the 20th when it should have first been delivered, and they sent it to me. What they'd done is they tried to access the wrong part of my building. And although there is a buzzer system there as well, they couldn't have rung the buzzer system because it, you know, nobody was ever alert. Anyway, look, it doesn't matter. The point is we've got it now. And Miss Jones, I wish you the very, very best of luck in acquiring your passport. Because I would imagine with the book you're currently writing, you're going to need to do a bit of travelling, aren't you, to do your research.
I'm a bit beyond that stage now, Mike. You know, I do have that sort of frantic scrabbling around where I am tracking down people to do the interviews and gathering all my material, reading everything, watching everything, listening to everything.
Yeah.
I'm sort of through that stage now to the writing stage. Mm. Very intense, focused, head down over a hot PC. And I'm in that zone now. And it's working really well. I get quite obsessed to the point that I get very jealous about my time.
Right.
And anything that wants to take me away from my desk.
Yes.
To do something else.
Yes.
I'm a bit resentful of because I'm now on a roll and really enjoying the writing as well. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad about that. We've got to get up and enjoy the day. I totally agree with you there, Miss Jones. Have you ever heard of a bloke called Leslie Bricusi?
Oh, yeah, just died.
Yeah, I just heard about it.
Great figure in musical theatre.
Mm.
Greatly revered. I think he was 90-something, wasn't he?
He was 90, I think. But
a good innings.
His most famous song, which is one of my favourite film theme tunes of all time, Goldfinger. And he strikes, oh no, that's Thunderball, isn't it? Strikes like Thunderball. But Goldfinger, you know, who sang that? It was Shirley Bassey, wasn't it? You know,
that was Shirley Bassey, yeah, but that was quite a fine impersonation of her there.
Oh, thank you. His heart is cold, Mr. Goldfinger. Yeah, I thought it was quite good.
Not my favourite Bond theme, actually. I'll tell you which one is.
Yeah.
I absolutely love, and I don't think it's ever been better, is Live and Let Die.
Well, I love Live and Let Die because it's a McCartney tune, isn't it? And that takes us nicely to the next thing we've got to talk about, and that, of course, is Paul McCartney. Because when I read originally that he was publishing a book full of his lyrics, I thought, well, kind of so what? You know, you can get the lyrics to the Beatles songs online. I bought books with the lyrics years ago with the music attached and all that kind of stuff. But then I started reading the serialization of this book, and it's not just the lyrics, it's a massive explanation of all of his best songs and why he wrote the lyrics and the story behind it and what inspired him. And I know we always talk about the Beatles in these podcasts because, you know, they're worth talking about, frankly, over the decades and the centuries, but it's opened my eyes again to a whole new level of genius of Paul McCartney and John Lennon, which even I, as a would-be student of the Beatles, had never quite comprehended.
Indeed, this is The Lyrics, a book coming out on the 2nd of November. As you say, based on these 154 songs he's treating in this book, including the unrecorded song, Tell Me Who He Is.
Mm.
And these arose out of conversations that Macca had with a poet, an Irish poet called Paul Muldoon. And he's taken songs like Blackbird, Live and Let Die, Hey Jude, Band on the Run, Yesterday. And he's gone behind the songs back into his original inspirations and bits of his life, you know, things that were happening to him at that time and things that led him to create these lyrics and to compose those songs.
Mm.
This is Paul's autobiography, really. He never wanted to do such a memoir straight, as it were.
Yeah.
So he's done it through songs. And I think that's absolutely fitting.
Oh, I totally agree. I'm not sure I've got the title right, but I think it's My Little Girl, which he wrote about his mother after his mother died. When
I Lost My Little Girl, wasn't it?
Yeah, I Lost My Little Girl. Now, I was never aware of that song until, you know, remember the thing in the car with James Corden?
Karaoke.
Yeah.
Carpool
karaoke. McCartney jumps in. It was a great success. Everybody did it. Adele did it and all sorts of people did it. But he was singing I Lost My Little Girl. And, you know, as a Beatles devotee for 4 or 5 decades, I thought, I can't remember which LP that was on. It's never actually been published, has it?
I don't remember, actually. There are so many. But that story is talked about in my book on John Lennon.
Oh, yeah.
So have another look in there because you might find some more information.
Yes, OK, that's fine. I certainly will. But as for all the other songs, the other thing that came to me was everybody said, oh, well, you know, Lennon and McCartney never really wrote a song together after sort of 1965. They were all individual compositions. And yet even on Hey Jude, even though John Lennon didn't write a word of Hey Jude, McCartney credits him with having a huge influence on the song just by commenting on it and giving his opinion on this line, his opinion on that line, and would that sound better in that key and all that kind of stuff. So truly, they were still working together right till the end.
I think that Paul was always in thrall to John. He was so impressed by John, right the way down the line. Mm. You know, when they met, John was 17, Paul was 15, the little wet behind the ears kid being taken to have the first meeting with this guy who was already a musician. And I think that that relationship remained with them right the way down the line.
Yeah.
Paul was always in awe of John and always sought his opinion and was always so wounded by him.
Yes.
When he was...
when he caustic towards him.
Yeah, he was very caustic.
Yeah.
And I think that that never left him. You know, those fundamental childhood relationships that we have...
Yeah.
We can be cast right back there just by bumping into somebody who treated us badly or very well when we were little.
That's right. Yeah. Paul's granny music is what John used to call some of his songs, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was jealous of Paul. Paul's great virtuosity. You know, he was a much better musician than John.
Yeah, in reality.
But John had so much more that made him the greatest rock star.
Yeah, no, as your book was entitled, of course. Now, Miss Jones, being a lady of extreme virtue and being a church warden and also being of a not too elderly age, you won't remember the film Clockwork Orange, will you?
I never saw it, no.
That's what I mean, because I reckon you'd have probably been about 8 or something when it came out. It's now celebrating its half century, and Malcolm McDowell was the star of it. And I saw him being interviewed this morning, but what a shocking film that was. If you've never seen it, maybe you should, because it was just remarkable. It was so ahead of its time, so unlike anything that had ever been made before. And Stanley Kubrick, the guy whose book upon which it was based, was one of the oddest blokes in the world, who I think banned the film from being shown about 3 years after it was released.
I think you've got that the wrong way around, because I think Stanley Kubrick was the director.
Oh, was he? Oh, yeah. Right, OK. Well, in that case, he made the film, did he? Yeah, all right. I'm not sure who wrote it then. Maybe there wasn't a book. Maybe it was just Stanley Kubrick's imagination or something. But it was a shocking, shocking film. The problem for Malcolm McDowell, who was, I think he was about 26 when he made that film, and he became the arch supervillain. And the, do you remember the image of his face and his eye, with one eyelash on one eye but not on the other, his painted face before even David Bowie started painting his face?
I have no recollection of that whatsoever.
Is that right?
Well, I thought Malcolm McDowell was a writer.
No, he's not.
Anthony Burgess, you're right. Anthony Burgess wrote the novel.
Oh, right, okay, there you go.
And Malcolm McDowell plays Alex, a Beethoven-loving, head-bashing punk.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. They used to go around setting fire to tramps and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean?
Oh, horrible.
Yeah.
I would have hated that film. Yeah. Yes, Stanley Kubrick was the screenwriter and the director.
Screenwriter and director, right, well done. But it kind of changed the world. And I was going to say about Malcolm McDowell, he's never ever been remembered for anything else, and it was 50 years ago, you know what I mean? So that sometimes happens. You know, you peak too early, don't you? That's the other thing I was going to tell you about as well. I know you don't watch a lot of telly, but Succession, this incredible mega series out of America, the third series has started, first episode starring Brian Cox, the great Scottish actor, and it is so powerful. You wouldn't believe it. I do urge you to get into Succession, Miss Jones.
No, I'm not going to. These things that become cult series, you know, they don't do it for me. A few times this past fortnight, my youngest daughter's been with me and we've sat down after dinner to try and watch something. Mm. And we go through all the channels and all the Netflix stuff and all the, you know, the other stuff. And I don't want sex. I don't want violence. Yeah. I don't want anything that's going to keep me awake at night. Yeah. And there's nothing to watch. Mm. So we end up parting company because we can't find something we want to watch together.
Yeah.
And I end up watching old reruns of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or The Chase.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there were Lassie films on every night, I would watch those. Yeah. I'm just really terrible at anything challenging that's going to disturb me.
Golly, there's because at the moment there's too much to watch, and I have to write them all down in my diary so I don't forget to watch them when I've got a spare minute, you know. To
well, how do you get all this time to watch television? I very rarely have time.
Usually after about, I would say usually after about 7:30 in the evening. I always watch Coronation Street at 7:30, and then at 8 o'clock I've got usually about a free hour to catch up on something if I can. And there's one at the moment, by the way. I know you. Television bores you to death, but there's one called Hollington Drive. It's a most fascinating story. It's two sisters who've both got children, a third family who live in the same road as them. A little boy goes missing and is found dead in a pond. And then,
that turns me off for a start. I'm not going to watch something that has something about dead children because that's going to upset me.
And then the two sisters go to war because both of their children tell an alternative story as to what happened to the little boy who's died. I mean, it is bone-chilling stuff, you know. But anyway, look, I perfectly accept what you're saying there, and I wouldn't worry about that. Now, I'm thinking about taking to the waves, Miss Jones. I was down in Poole last week, right? Went down, had some business to sort out on the south coast, and I had an opportunity to go and see my sister for the first time in 15 months in Bournemouth.
Wow, is it that long since you've seen her?
Yes, that long, that long.
Oh, how was it? How was this sort of reunion? Did you cry?
No, didn't cry, but it was very nice. You know, it's very warm, very nice, and it's amazing, really, because in 15 months, you've kind of forgotten what people look like, and believe it or not.
You absolutely do. That's astonishing. How was she? Did she cry?
No, she didn't. No, we're quite stoic. I mean, we keep in touch, you know, every other day on the phone, you know, sending messages and WhatsApp and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't a complete break off, but to actually physically be in present. And we had a traditional Sunday lunch, you know, first family one for probably, I don't know, 15 or 18 months or something like that. It was absolutely lovely.
Marvellous. What did you have?
Roast beef. Because that is
what with Yorkshire pudding and
yes, with all of that
gravy and all that, yeah.
And we had what my mum used to call Swede carrots and turnips. Okay, I don't know
how
if you ever
had that. Swede?
I don't know, but it's carrots and then the turnips are mixed up. But I think my mum used to call turnips Swede.
That's so sweet because Swede is a whole different thing, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know.
Yes, Swede is a separate vegetable.
It's like
you get turnips and Swede. So you can buy it when I make stew in wintertime.
Right.
I would buy turnips and Swede and also parsnips to put in the stew.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good to know. I'm not sure why I'm calling that. But anyway, all's my sisters ever do when we have Sunday lunches is just completely replicate what mum did for us for, you know, 20 or 30 years.
I think we all do that with a roast, don't we? We all cook the roast lunch. That our mothers made us.
Absolutely. But it's still
my very comforting about it.
I totally agree. It's still my favourite meal in the world. It's a bit more sophisticated these days. We have a gravy boat, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And
why is it called a boat? I've never understood that.
I don't know.
Because it's a jug, isn't it? Well, so why do we call it a boat?
I don't know. But, you know, in our day, mum would just go back to the cooker, get the pan and a spoon and come back and ladle a bit more gravy over your plate and all that kind of stuff.
But remember that when they used to make a massive great pan of of Yorkshire pudding. So it wasn't like the separate little Aunt Bessie's things
that people
make nowadays. They do a great big pan of it, like an oven pan.
Yeah.
And you'd have a wedge of it, almost the size of the plate, but
that's
square.
Right. That's right.
The gravy would go on top of that.
Yeah, you'd cut it
out. That was my favourite bit.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I used to relish that.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. And talking about boats, I was saying to you, I went over to Pool Quay. And Pool Quay's lovely. It overlooks a place called Brown's Sea Island. And
Baden Powell's place.
I was about to say there's a statue of Baden Powell sitting on a chair there, looking out to Brown's Sea Island. You know what I mean? But it's got a quay frontage, and then it's got old town streets behind it. There must be a dozen oldie worldy pubs there. It's the most beautiful place, honestly, Pool and Pool Quay. And I visited three or four of them, and they really are, you know, buildings built in the 16th, 17th century and that kind of stuff. And it's the sort of thing I really love. I love going to places like Old Town York and Chester and places like that. I've got medieval buildings turned into pubs. You know, it's my favourite part of my British heritage. But also, down in Poole, it's the home of Sunseeker boats. It's where they build the Sunseeker boats, okay? So I went down to the Sunseeker yard, and thank you very much to all the Sunseeker people who are all lovely and welcoming and all that kind of stuff, and had a look at some of these boats. My God.
They started about £1 million.
No, they started about £2 million, actually.
I have a friend who's got one. My friend Ozzy has a Sunseeker yacht.
Right.
He bought himself for his 50th birthday.
How lovely. Well, that must have been made in Poole, because that's where they make them. But most beautiful craft. They're not really yachts, and they're not motorboats, but there's something in between. Do you know what I mean?
So you're going to buy one of these?
I'm not thinking of buying one, because I couldn't afford one, to be honest, even if they were only £1 million. But what I'm thinking of is that there are some ways where you can make arrangements to kind of share one, which you use 6 times a year or something like that. You know what I mean?
Oh, like a timeshare. People used to have a timeshare apartment
yes.
in Mallorca or somewhere.
Yes, that's right, yes. And that would mean that, you know, there'd be a huge demand for them in the summer, but I'm not that bothered about summer. You know, I prefer spring and autumn. And you'd just gather a few friends and get down to Pool Quay and then get out into the, towards the Solent, really, and round, there's loads of islands around there. There's even an island there, believe it or not, next to Brownsea Island called Long Island. Although,
oh, is there? Oh, cool.
Yeah, very.
If you are looking for people to fill up there,
exactly.
I'll come and cook the Sunday lunch on board.
It would be great. Well, what happens is, actually, funny enough, you can hire a sort of crew for the day. And you get a helmsman who drives the boat, and you get his number two, and then you get two other people who look after you, you know what I mean, catering and drinks and all that kind of stuff. So it's all very, very civilised. And the thing I most love about them, although I'm not a great sort of summer sportsman myself, but they're all built with a platform at the back so you can dive off and, you know, don't need a diving board and all that kind of stuff. So that really, I looked at them and I thought, I've been wasting my life working in offices, you know, for 40 years. I should have been out on the high seas in one of these Sunseeker craft. Absolutely beautiful.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much for joining us. I've just been regaling you all, I'm Miss Jones, about the joys of... I really would love to have my own boat, but let's move on, because we've talked about that. Miss Jones, you were a friend of David Bowie. What do you make... Sorry?
I was.
Yours indeed, yeah. So what do you make of this story or this pronouncement or whatever it might be from somebody called Susan Sarandon? I think she's an Oscar-winning actress, so I can't remember anything I've ever seen.
You must have seen Thelma and Louise.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, okay. Who suddenly announces, I made my peace with David before he died. That's quite a regular refrain, isn't it, from people who attach themselves to more famous names when the famous name has passed on.
And also when their own fame is in decline.
Yes, I was about to say that, yeah.
She would never talk about her affair with Bowie in earlier days when she was a bigger name and mm-hmm. while he was still alive. Mm. And he's been dead a few years now, of course. But she says in a piece that appeared in You magazine last weekend mm-hmm. that she made it up with David Bowie before he died. They had a relationship after they co-starred in a horror film called The Hunger in 1983.
Right.
They were single at the time, they both were, and they had this affair. I think everybody thought she was older than him at the time, but mm-hmm. in fact, they were about the same age.
Right.
She's 75 now. He would have turned 75 next January.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a lot in it.
Mm.
It didn't last very long, and it probably split acrimoniously because these things always do.
Mm.
And then they didn't talk for years. He married Iman, the supermodel, in 92, and she got together with Tim Robbins.
Oh, yeah.
And they broke up 2009. Mm. So maybe she didn't talk about it because she was being discreet. She was with someone else.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't bring those things up, do you? But it seems an odd time to go back into that period of her life now.
Yes. I totally agree. And largely irrelevant to me as well. You know what I mean? I mean, the David Bowie legacy will stand forever. It's neither increased or decreased in my mind because Susan Sarandon has said she made it up with him before, you know, complete irrelevance. I didn't even think it was a story, to be honest.
It wasn't a story, and it was a cover story at that. So, standards are declining.
Mm.
But no, he's been dead 5 years. We tend not to talk about him anymore in terms of the person, the man, the personality.
Mm.
But it's all about the music with him, isn't it? Mm. And that music is with us for a long, long time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Getting to a more serious subject, I was working last week in Westminster on the day of the memorial service for Sir David Amess, okay? The MP who was stabbed to death in his constituency. Leon C in Southend, and the reason I was in Parliament because I was doing a radio show. I was doing LBC with Ian Dale, okay, and he was a great guy, by the way. Always loved to work with him. And the whole of Westminster was closed off, so I had to walk all the way round Westminster Abbey, which is a huge, huge building, to get to the studio on Millbank. But in that time, you know, I passed dozens of MPs who were coming away from the memorial service and all that. I ended up in the studio and I met the lady. You remember Jo Cox was an MP who also got murdered. And
yeah, her sister is now an MP, isn't she?
Kim Ledbetter. And I was about to say to you, I ended up in a studio with Kim Ledbetter. And it was honestly so poignant. You know, it was 3 days after Sir David was murdered. There was Kim Ledbetter talking about the grief of when her sister was murdered. Honestly, it had an enormous effect on me. I thought, God, the frailty of life. You're here 1 minute and gone the next. You know, I mean, a most terribly cruel and despicable act.
But it made me so angry because after Jo Cox was murdered, we heard all this from politicians and the police about how everything was going to change, protection plans were coming into place, and that MPs, when they do their surgeries, that they would be accompanied by police officers, none of which happened.
Yeah.
And why does the same thing have to go and happen 5 years down the line?
Mm.
When are they going to put measures into place?
Yeah, no, I
don't. It's been Brexit, COVID, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
It's been 5 years since Jo Cox, and here we are. We haven't moved on at all.
Yeah, I would have armed policemen standing outside the MP surgeries to deter anybody who thought it was a good idea to go in and stab to death an unarmed and innocent person, whether it be Jo Cox or David Amess. And when
have we got enough police officers?
Well, yes, we have. Yes, we have, because the surgeries take place for 2 or 3 hours about every other Saturday. And the police have got enough people to be able to investigate what they call hate crimes, which I'm not, you know, going to be against. You know, I don't want people to suffer hate crimes, but it's a non-specific form of crime. Whereas protecting somebody from being stabbed to death is a very specific form of crime. And do you remember the first time you've travelled all your life, Leslie-Anne? Do you remember the first time you might have walked into Heathrow or Gatwick and suddenly stopped in shock to see a policeman or woman with a machine gun positioned across their chest?
Oh, absolutely. It was terrifying. And I remember thinking, you know, you have that thing with an Alsatian. People have an Alsatian for, you know, 20 years or something.
Yeah.
The dog's never hurt a fly. And then suddenly there's a new baby in the family. Mm. And the Alsatian out of nowhere savages the baby and kills it.
Yeah.
And the owners say, but it was always so placid. It, you know, can't understand it. It never would hurt anything.
Yeah.
I would think that about those policemen and think, you know, they might be of complete sane mind when they were tested to see whether they were stable enough to have a machine gun on their body.
Yeah.
But that moment when the ping goes in the brain and they can suddenly see red and suddenly lose sanity and suddenly go with the machine gun all over the airport and start killing people.
Well, yeah, but I mean, are you saying then that you don't want to see armed policemen in airports?
It was at such point blank range. I was standing right next to the guy.
Yes.
And it frightened me.
It's shocking. I agree. I
thought he could turn around and shoot me.
Yeah, but they're there to protect you, not to shoot you. And I don't think I've ever heard of a case where a policeman has suddenly gone mad and used the gun that he was carrying to attack passengers, you know. So I think you're being a little bit, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? A little bit sensationalist in your thought, I think, because I don't think
dramatic.
That would ever happen.
Dramatic, as my Auntie Jane would say.
What was that?
A bit dramatic.
Yes, a bit dramatic.
Very Welsh, my auntie.
Yes, that's right, a bit dramatic. But no, I do remember the shock. And the reason I mention that is because when I've raised this with people that I think armed policemen, they said, no, that's very un-British. And I thought it was very un-British to see, you know, machine gun wielding policemen at airports, but that's the way society has changed. What do you think about Earl Spencer now saying, right, if there is not a prosecution against Martin Bashir initiated by the legal forces, by the police or by the Crown, I'm going to take a civil case against the BBC. Is this Earl Spencer literally beating the drum and shining a beacon for his long departed sister, the most famous woman in the world? Or has he got ulterior motives?
It was a very good question. I mean, if you think about what's happened, right, the Dyson report exposing the cover-up that went on for 25 years.
Yes.
And I think we knew already that those who protest at BBC fail upwards, while the whistleblowers are victimised for bringing the corporation into disrepute.
Yes.
So £3.5 billion of our money goes to running the BBC. We want more than what we have from the BBC right now.
Yeah.
There is a rotten corporate culture. Nobody has been held personally responsible for what went wrong over this Bashir Diana case.
Mm.
He falsified evidence to secure that interview. And that should have ended his career.
Mm.
But he went on to glory. And I think there's some guilt on Earl Spencer's part here. He failed to protect his sister. He needs to assuage that guilt.
Mm.
And he's not going to let them get away with it.
Mm.
He is going to dig and dig until Bashir falls. And I see, you know, there's no lack of money here.
Yeah.
There's no lack of intent. There's no lack of dedication.
Mm.
He is going to make this his cause celebre. He's on a mission.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested to watch this space because he could go all the way.
Yeah, I've never understood his motives. I mean, when she was alive, we learned after she died, there was an accusation that he wouldn't allow Diana to live on the family estate because he thought it would attract too many photographers and too much publicity. And, you know, she was desperate for solace in those days. She was desperate for a hidey hole. She was desperate for some protection and privacy. And yet, according to the reports I've read, he turned her away.
Well, hence the guilt that I've just mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
He feels guilty. He failed to protect her. When she needed him most,
yeah.
He turned her down.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he does need to actually put things straight with his deceased sister. He needs to, I suppose he's feeling that he's going to have to look her in the eye again at some point and feel accountable.
Or look in the eyes of William and Harry. I know they don't get on these days, but, you know, they're still family and all that kind of stuff. But
they're the nephews that he stood up at her funeral and swore he would protect
for
the rest of the time. And there hasn't been that much of a relationship since.
No, there hasn't.
So there's a lot of regret in Earl Spencer's mind, I would say.
Yeah.
And I've asked myself this question, in his shoes, would I do the same thing? And I think probably I would.
Yes. Well, yeah, I totally agree. I think he's trying to row back the years, isn't he? And convert. But talking about BBC people, by the way, I was very saddened to read that George Alagaya is taking another break from his newsreading role because, sadly, his cancer has spread once again. I mean, I don't know how those people survive mentally when you know that the cancer is creeping up on you and then you think it's gone and then, oh dear, I've got a diagnosis, it's come back again and all that. I mean, you're looking at, you know, a worst case scenario, which is sort of unbearable for the rest of your family.
Yeah, it's a sort of Damocles scenario, isn't it? You're never free of cancer. Even when they've given you the all clear, you are never free.
Yeah.
You've always got that worry that it will return. And unfortunately, it usually does.
Yes. It's very blunt of you to say that, but it's very true. And my broadcasting colleague, Jackie Beltrayo, who's the sports reporter on Sky.
She's gone through the same thing, hasn't she?
I think she's going through it for the third time now. And my God, you know, the courage that woman has. She goes very public on it. She thinks that, you know, that kind of helps her and it helps, you know, her family because she's not hiding anything away and she posts videos and, you know, here's some treatment she's having and all that. My God, I admire her so well. And what it should do to all of us is that those who are not in that position should thank our lucky stars because you quite rightly say it's so prevalent in modern society. I think the statistic is that one in three of us in the end will get some form of cancer.
I think it's one in two now, actually.
Yes.
But when we were kids, cancer was a dirty word.
Oh, I totally agree.
You didn't say it. You didn't admit it.
No.
I remember when my Auntie Frieda got divorced and it was a shameful thing. My mother even said, don't go into school and talk about it. You know, we don't talk about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And feeling awful just because someone in the family, not even somebody in our close family, but it was the same thing with cancer. People didn't say the word. We called it the C word.
Yes.
And you didn't talk about it. But nowadays, I think it's so important that we do.
Yeah.
It's so important for us to be able to say openly, women, check your breasts. Mm. You know, when you're in the shower or when you come out and you're drying with a towel, you know, do the whole thing of lifting your arm up in front of the mirror and going round with your fingertips in both directions around your breast. Mm. Nothing shameful in that. Yeah. We all have to be aware. Men have to do it with their testicles as well.
Yes,
and we must be shy about this kind of thing because shyness does not save lives.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Do you know Dylan Jones?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Did you see his spread this week in which he wrote this piece saying the 80s were the greatest era for music? And I think we've spoken about this in the past. And I think you agree with him, don't you, about the 80s?
I don't really. I mean, part of me says that we tend to think that the best musical era is the one we grew up in, the music when we were dancing around our handbags in the clubs.
Sure.
But, of course, all decades have their merits. I would say except for the 90s, the Britpop era. Were we just too old for that? I think we might have been. It just didn't do it for me. The whole suede and blur and, oh, the Spice Girls and all that kind of stuff. It was sort of sub-music to me.
Yeah.
I'd had too much music by then. And I've gone back to my original music, of course. I think the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, there's not much new now that's coming along.
No,
I mean, yes, we've got Adele, but we had Adele before. There's a wonderful artist who's signed to Ireland called Sigrid. I don't know if you've come across her.
No.
Well, you heard this here first. She is their great hope for the Christmas number one. And I was played that single earlier on this week in secret.
Yes.
And it's absolutely astonishing. It'll certainly give Celeste a run for her money.
Right. Now, hang on. What's her name? Siegfried?
Sigrid.
Sigrid. Is she Irish?
No, Swedish, I believe.
Oh, Swedish, okay. And she's got a record coming out, which you've already heard, and you think it's a smash hit, do you?
I think it could be the Christmas number one. It was amazing. It's a song that's been around before, but is this a word? Christmassified it.
Right.
It's very jingly and tangly and very feel good. Mm. It's one of those songs you hear the first few bars and you think that's a hit.
Right.
That is absolutely a hit.
Yeah. Because
I really loved it.
Oh, well, I'm glad about that. That's great. Because with the Adele thing, I cannot believe the impact Adele has had on the world with the release of a new album coming up called, I think, 30. I mean, on both sides of the Atlantic. She's the front cover of Vogue magazine. She's doing 1 hour specials on Australian TV. I had no idea that Adele had, you know, gone to those heights, because I do quite like Adele's songs, particularly the one that was the theme music for the James Bond film.
Skyfall.
Skyfall, thank you very much. And it's a skyfall. But to me, all Adele's records...
Is that all we get?
Yeah, that's the only bit I know. but to me, all Adele's records sound exactly the same.
Well, they don't sound exactly the same, but there is a sort of recognisable theme about them.
Yeah.
Adele, by the way, I'm sure I've told you this before, used to stack my dishwasher.
Yeah, you told me.
My daughter was at the Brit School with her, and they were all in the same year. Although my daughter wasn't doing music, she was doing theatre.
Yeah.
I'm a bit cross with her about this single, Go Easy on Me, because it celebrates divorce.
And says to her children, oh, I'm really sorry if I messed up your lives. I mean,
exactly. Well, she's got one child at the moment.
Yeah.
But it's saying to that little boy, I put my own feelings before yours.
Mm.
And I'm sorry, but I feel very strongly that once you have children,
yeah,
their feelings always have to come first.
Yes.
You can't suddenly get fed up with the person or the marriage and go, I'm out of here. I'm looking for something better.
Mm.
Because you have a responsibility to your children to bring them up in a family. And the hurt that is caused by going through a divorce, actually, I think, always afflicts a child. They never really get over that.
Mm.
The same as the partner who is left never really gets over that.
Yeah.
And I know that in some cases kids can be very unhappy if parents are fighting all the time and it's a very unhealthy environment.
Mm.
But I don't think write a song and put a song out there that's going, guess what, babe? Mm. You know, my feelings mattered more than yours. I just think it's a little bit trite, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The other thing is, of course, that the Adele we see today is so physically different to the Adele that was a hit last time around 3 or 4 years ago. I simply can't, in my head, I can't get the images into line. They're so different.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was wondering whether her voice might have changed because she lost so much weight.
Yes.
Because it does happen if your physique changes, you know, your larynx moves into a different position, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And her voice does sound more mature and more controlled, but you'd expect that now that she's 33.
Yeah, no, I suppose you would. I tell you what I was going to talk to you about, and it's not a fun subject at all. I read that the public sector pension debt or obligation in this country is £2.4 trillion. So that is people who've worked in the public sector. So they've worked for government, or they've worked for local authorities, or they've worked for the National Health Service. Most of them are retired by the age of 55, I'm told, although, you know, there are obviously those who go on to 60 and even elder. But they have gold-plated pensions and have for years. And I think it's an absolute blinking scandal. I'm told that one-third of your council tax bill is now to pay the pensions of people who've worked there but now retired. That is an utter and absolute scandal to the working person in this country.
It's appalling, especially considering so many of us don't have private pensions.
Exactly.
Speaking personally, I lost my private pension in my divorce.
Shocking.
And I don't have one.
Yeah.
My father lost his pension at the Mirror when Robert Maxwell went over
Indeed.
The side.
Indeed.
And people said, oh, he would have had that paid back, surely. Well, no, because he left the paper and he went to the Independent.
Yeah.
He wasn't entitled to it.
No.
It never came. I do think this is a scandal and they do need to do something about it.
Mm.
They need to bring it into line. It should be equal for everybody.
Yeah.
So if they've got these gold-plated pensions, why hasn't everybody else?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. It all changed once the Blair Brown government came in. Gordon Brown decided not just to level up, you know, the benefits of public service workers to the private sector. He let the pendulum swing completely the other way. And so the public sector are now far better paid and far better protected than anybody who works in the private sector. He also managed to smash private pension industry to pieces by suddenly taxing dividends from pension funds, which cost £5 billion a year to the industry. This is all very technical, and our listeners are not going to get that that worked up about it, but it does affect us all. I lost my pension as well, but not in the cruel fashion that you lost yours, Leslie-Ann. When my heart went, which was in 2004, I had a very decent pension pot. And if I'd have hung around for another probably 15 years or something, I'd now be getting about £70,000 a year. But as I thought I was probably going to die in the next 2 or 3 years, I cashed it in. And I put the money down on a deposit on buying a new property. And of course, I did all right out of that. But it'd be very nice to wake up every morning knowing that you've got £70,000 a year coming in without even getting out of bed.
So could you not sell the property and invest the money?
Well, I could, of course, but that brings into scope all sorts of tax problems as well. You have to pay value-added tax on your property and all that.
Sure, they get us every which way, don't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Capital gains tax, it's called in property, not value-added tax, by the way. My mistake. And you pay 40% of the difference between when you bought it and when you sell it. And in the case of the property I'm talking about, that's about £200,000. So that would be another £80,000 in tax. So, you know, you really don't know what
to do. That's disgraceful. So they're clobbering you. You earned that money. You
yes.
paid tax on that money.
Yes.
You then invested that money in property.
Yeah.
That ought to be yours.
Of course it should.
However it flourishes and increases.
Yeah.
With interest, that ought to be yours. You shouldn't have to pay tax on it again.
Well, you pay tax on it another time, if and when I die, which of course we all do, when my estate is wrapped up. Yes, when my estate is wrapped up, when it's over the ceiling level, which I think is about £365,000, everything over that will again be taxed in death duties. It's an utter scandal. If you get up off your own, you know, if you get onto your own 2 feet and try and make your way in this life, you are clobbered. Whereas, and I've got nothing against public service workers, many of them provide a vital service, but my goodness gracious me, they live in a pretty cosseted world when it comes to finances.
Well, they do. And then you've got the sector of our country who never actually work a day in their entire lives.
Yeah, have got.
Who,
yeah.
When they get to the other end of their lives, get everything paid for
because they
haven't got anything.
That's right.
So, you know, some people are paying £6,000 a week to keep their parents in a care home.
Yes.
And you've got other people who came in with nothing who are getting it all paid for them.
Yeah, and their rents and everything else. I know it seems a very unjust world, but we are a very caring society and, you know, we've got to find the balance somewhere. Right. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for having tuned in today. Ms. Jones, I hope you're going to have a very fruitful weekend and week ahead. And
thank you, Michael. I hope you do too.
Yes, I will indeed. And to all our listeners, thank you very much. Back with you next week. We keep in touch, you know, every other day on the phone, you know, sending messages and WhatsApp and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't a complete break off, but to actually physically be in present. And we had a traditional Sunday lunch, you know, first family one for probably, I don't know, 15 or 18 months or something like that. It was absolutely lovely.
Marvellous. What did you have?
Roast beef, because that is
very much. What, with Yorkshire pudding and...
Yes, with all of that.
Gravy and all that, yeah.
And we had what my mum used to call swede, carrots and turnips, okay? I don't know
how
if you've
ever... How is that swede?
I don't know, but it's carrots and then the turnips are mixed up, but I think my mum used to call turnips swede.
That's so sweet, because swede is a whole different thing, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know.
Yes, swede is a separate vegetable.
It's like...
You get turnips and swede. So you can buy it when I make stew in wintertime.
Right.
I would buy turnips and swede and also parsnips to put in the stew.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good to know. I don't think I've ever heard of a case where a policeman has suddenly gone mad and used the gun that he was carrying to attack passengers, you know. So I think you're being a little bit... I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? A little bit sensationalist in your thought, I think, because I don't think
dramatic.
That would ever happen.
Dramatic, as my Auntie Jane would say.
What? What was that?
A bit dramatic.
Yes, a bit dramatic.
Very Welsh, my Auntie Jane.
Yes. Goldfinger. And he strikes, oh no, that's Thunderball, isn't it? He strikes like Thunderball. But Goldfinger, you know, who sang that? It was Shirley Bassey, wasn't it? You know,
that was Shirley Bassey, yeah, but that was quite a fine impersonation of her there.
Oh, thank you. His heart is cold.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.